going to study Daniel 9. Daniel 9 is a prophecy that's a little different from the other lines of prophecy in the book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, there are four great outline prophecies. Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, and Daniel 11. And these are called outline prophecies because they review the history of nations to go on into the future. But Daniel 9 is different. It's set apart. It's directed to one particular group of people. And the angel Gabriel says to Daniel, "This is for your people and your holy city." It's a special prophecy for the Jewish nation and the Jewish people at the time. I had a little bit of personal experience with this prophecy. I became an Adventist Christian when I was a senior in high school in California. My father, whom I've mentioned a time or two from the pulpit, was not a religious man. He was an agnostic. He was the kind of person who would say, "Well, maybe there's a God, maybe there isn't, I don't know, I don't care." So as I became an Adventist Christian, I always wanted to study the Bible with him, but he would never let me talk about it. But one time we were sitting out in the backyard on a Saturday afternoon. It was warm, sunny, very pleasant day. So he allowed me to give him a Bible study, the only time he ever let me speak about religion to him. And I gave him a Bible study on Daniel 9. I had no interest in that occasion of connecting it with the 2300 days. I wanted to use this prophecy to demonstrate to him that 6 centuries before Jesus of Nazareth came on the earth, there was a prophecy that showed exactly who he was, when he would come, where he would come, and what he would do. I would like to tell you that when I finished the Bible study, my father said, "Okay, I'll become a Christian." That was not the case. But what he did say was, he said, "Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. That's about as much as he would grudgingly admit." Well, Daniel, we find him in the first year of Darius the Mede. Who's Darius the Mede? He's a vassal king under the Persian emperor. The Persian emperor is Cyrus at the time. And Darius is a local king of Babylon. And it's the first year, so we know we have come to the time of the Persians. The kings of Babylon have passed away. They've been conquered. And so now we're in the Persian period. And Daniel has been there all that time under those Babylonian kings. So he's been there almost 70 years himself. And we find him with an open Bible, an open scroll. And the scroll that he's reading is Jeremiah. And he's reading what we would call Jeremiah chapter 25, which is the prophecy that the people of Judah would be in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. And he's been there just about 70 years. So he knows it's time for the people of God to go home. He knows it's time for them to build up their city and their temple and restore their country as it was before. And so he's praying. Now that's a very good position in which to find yourself, with an open Bible and praying over an open Bible. And that's what Daniel was doing. And if you want an example of a beautiful intercessory prayer of somebody praying not for themselves, but for somebody else, this prayer of Daniel is it. He's praying for his people. He's praying for forgiveness for their sins that led to the exile. And he's praying for their restoration. And God sends him an answer. And he sends him a very direct answer, because he sends an angel messenger to communicate to him that his prayers will be answered. And the angel Gabriel comes to him and says, "Oh, Daniel, you're a man greatly beloved." Now, Daniel is an old, old man at this time. He's almost 90 years of age. He's been in captivity for 70 years. Let's say he was about 20 when he went into captivity. That's 90. Here's a man 90 years of age. And you might say, God might say, "Well, I'm sorry, Daniel, you're a little too old to be a useful prophet to me anymore. So I'm going to set you aside. I'm going to take a younger prophet." That's not what God did. God says, "Oh, Daniel, you're greatly beloved. And you're still my faithful servant, even at the tender age of 90. Now, sometimes elderly people in the church feel they're kind of set aside. But God says to them, My dear brother, my dear sister, you're greatly beloved, even in your aged years. And then he says, now consider the word that I bring you and understand the vision. That's the vision that preceded Daniel 8. And he says, now understand, with the words that I give you, you'll understand that prophecy better. So let's start in with verse 24, which we've already had in our reading. And I'll read the Shea Revised Version. 70 weeks are cut off upon your people and your holy city. Now, the translation that we had read sevens, and that's common. But the original word is weeks. And if some of you have the old King James, you will notice that in that version it's translated weeks. 70 weeks are cut off upon your people. What's the difference? Well, the number seven, the word for weeks is derived from the number seven, but it's not the same word. Different vowels, which gives a different pronunciation. And the word used here is weeks. Now, why is that significant? Well, a week has 7 days, and that implies that we must use the year-day principle to understand this prophecy. That each day and each one of those weeks stands for a historical year as you stretch that prophecy into the future. You see, a literal time here would not do, because it would only get 70 weeks would give you about a year and a half. And in all that time, the Jews are supposed to go back, build up their temple, build up their city, and the Messiah is supposed to come. There's just not enough time. It's not literal time. It's symbolic time, and it stands for this projection by this year-day principle. And then it says, cut off. 70 weeks are cut off. Now, the problem is the translators don't understand the relationship between Daniel 9 and Daniel 8. This is a rare word. This is one of these words in the Old Testament that's only used once. So if you don't have any comparative words elsewhere, how do you define this word? Well, the easiest way is to go to later Hebrew. And there was a compilation of Jewish writings called the Mishnah, written in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries A.D. In the Mishnah, this word is used 8 or 9 times, and it almost always means to cut. And so that's the next logical source to our understanding the meaning of this word. So 70 weeks are cut off of a longer time period, and that's the 2,300 days of the preceding prophecy. Now, this verse 24 is a summary. And after that, verses 25 to 27 are the details. This is not the way we would write. We write all the, we collect all the details, and then we give the summary at the end of the chapter. Daniel gives you the summary first, and then he fills in the details. And in verse 24, he gives you 6 things that are going to happen by the time this 70 weeks or 490 years has passed by. And the first two are the responsibility of the Jewish people to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin. In other words, God wanted a pure people ready for the coming of the Messiah. This was their charge. This was their responsibility. And sad to say, as we read the story of the Gospels, they were not ready. They had not accomplished these tasks by the time the Messiah came. The next pair is responsibility that God took upon himself to atone for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness. Now, in the Old Testament times, there was a problem with the sacrificial system. You would bring him an animal, you would sacrifice the animal, the priest would manipulate the blood either to the altar or into the sanctuary, and you would be forgiven. The summary in Leviticus many times over is, and thus the priest shall do, and he shall be forgiven. But the problem is that people still continued to sin. So you had to go back again, and again, and again, and again. What we need is not a series of animals to take care of our sins. We need one great, final atoning sacrifice. And that was given not by bulls and rams and lambs, but by the Lord Jesus Christ on the cross when he died. Once for all. No need for another atoning sacrifice after that. And that accomplishes something. It accomplishes our forgiveness, and it brings to us a righteousness that we do not naturally possess. And we call that righteousness by faith, because by our faith we grasp what Jesus did there on the cross for us. And that righteousness is ongoing. It's here today. It's available to you today. What Jesus did 1900 years ago provides a righteousness that you can access today and make part of your life and existence. And it goes on. Its effects go on into eternity. And the last two phrases are the results. To seal both vision and profit. Notice carefully the word prophet. It's not the word prophecy. It's the word prophet, the one who brings the prophecies. Now, as we have spread out the dates of this prophecy, we have come to the year 34 AD, 3 years after Jesus died. And we have isolated the event of the stoning of Stephen in Acts chapter 7 and said this is the terminal point. Now, that's a little unusual. I mean, after all, there were other Christians. Paul says that he martyred other Christians. Why do we pick out this one particular martyr to mark the end of this probationary period of time? There are several unique features about Stephen. Number one, notice where he was preaching. He was preaching before the Sanhedrin, the highest religious body of the nation. And notice the nature of his speech. He reviews the mighty acts of God on behalf of his people through the Old Testament. Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and Joshua and David and Solomon. And then he cuts it off. He can see that his audience is not receptive. So the second point is he gives a speech like the Old Testament prophets did. It's called a covenant lawsuit speech. And the prophets would review the gracious acts of God on behalf of his people. And then they would say, but you are violating his covenant and his laws. You are a wicked and rebellious and stiff-necked people. So number one, he gives a speech before the highest religious authorities in the land. Number two, he gives a speech like the Old Testament prophets did when they brought the accusations of God against his people. And number three, he is a prophet who has the shortest ministry of any prophet in the Bible. Now, as he was dying, being stoned, he looks up into heaven and he sees Jesus standing at the right hand of the throne of the Father. And he cries out about it, and as he dies, he has a vision. Now, my understanding is by definition, people who have visions of God are prophets. Therefore, Stephen was a prophet. Only for a moment, the shortest prophetic ministry in the Bible, but a highly significant one because he was witnessing to the religious leaders of the nation as the probationary period of time of the nation passed. And as he dies, his lips are sealed. No more prophecies uttered from his lips or from any more Jewish prophets. Now think about that. There are other prophets in the New Testament, but there's a difference. They are prophets who prophesy to the Christian church. The prophet has been sealed, the prophecy given by the prophet, by the lips and the words of Stephen, is sealed up. And finally, it says to anoint a holy of holies or a most holy place. And as you know, at the time of Jesus' ascension, he took upon himself a new work. Our heavenly high priest, whose work is described so well in the book of Hebrews. Then it gives the details. Starting with verse 25, we have the details. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the word or decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem, unto the coming of the anointed prince, there should be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So we add that up, 69 weeks, and we multiply that out, and it comes out to 483 years. Now, at the corner of my lot, there is a little nail, or you could call it a spike, which identifies the corner of my property. And as they were building the house, they would use a transit to sight from that and to lay out the lot. And so when we study these time prophecies, we need to put in the spike. We need to put in the nail from which we stretch out the 70 weeks or the 490 years or the 2300 days. And so it's important to get that spike put in the right place, because if you get it put in the wrong place, you'll come to the wrong conclusion. Now, sometimes when we have these prophetic events in the Old Testament, we don't have enough information to really do a full evaluation. That's different here. In this case, we have all kinds of information back in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. In fact, we have four decrees that dealt with the Jewish people. Not one, but four. And so you have to sort through them and figure out which one fits the best. Cyrus gives a decree in Ezra chapter 1, and that decree is for the return of the people and the building of the temple. They got stopped, so it took a second decree, this time by Darius the Great, another Persian king. And he confirms the decree of Cyrus, the building of the temple. Building a temple is not building a city. Ezra chapter 7 is the decree which Artaxerxes the king gives to Ezra himself. You see, there were two returns. The first return is with Zerubbabel, and he brought 55,000 people back from the Babylonian captivity. Ezra comes with a second return, and 7,000 people followed him. And when he gets there, they actually start building on the city of Jerusalem. There is a letter from the western governors in Ezra chapter 4 written to King Artaxerxes. So even though it seems to be in a different place in the book, you know to whom the letter has been written. It's written to Artaxerxes. And they say, "O king, the people who came up from you have gone to Jerusalem, and they are building that wicked and rebellious city, and if you let it be built, you're going to lose tax money." And so the king writes and says, "Okay, tell them to suspend building for the time being." So Ezra's group that came back from Artaxerxes went to Jerusalem, started the building, but the western governors got them stopped. So now it takes a letter of authorization to Nehemiah in Nehemiah chapter 1. And in Nehemiah chapter 1, he's given the authority to go back to Jerusalem. And we have the story of his survey of the broken down walls of Jerusalem. And so he surveys the broken down walls, and then he gets all the tribes and all the clans together, and he organizes them, and they get the wall up. You have to have the wall up so that you have protective defenses. Then you can build the inside of the city at your leisure. So the decree we want is when the building starts, and that's the one with Ezra. And in Ezra chapter 7, it tells us that decree was given in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. Now, there have been people who have attacked the date of 457 for this decree, but I would say, look, if you're going to attack somebody's theories, attack them at a weak point, not a strong point. It so happens that we have four different lines of evidence for the dates of King Artaxerxes. First of all, there was a Jewish astronomer named Ptolemy. And he wrote in the city of Alexandria in the 2nd century A.D. And he compiled what is called Ptolemy's Canon. And Ptolemy's Canon is a list of kings back to 747 B.C. dated in terms of the eclipses that occurred during the reigns of these kings. And two of those eclipses occurred in the reign of King Artaxerxes. So from Ptolemy's Canon we can fix his dates. Then there was an interesting discovery in Egypt. A man purchased a trunk full of papyri. And they stayed in that trunk for 20 years, and finally somebody got to studying them and found these were letters from Jews in Egypt. It so happened these Jews were working as in the Persian military on an outpost in South Egypt, and an island in the Nile called Elephantine, and these papyri are called the Elephantine papyri. Now, they have dates on each letter, and the dates are given in two calendars, in the Egyptian calendar and the Persian calendar. And the mathematical crosses of these dates come to only one specific point in each case, which fixes, and since these letters cross the reign of Artaxerxes, that fixes the dates in another way. And in the third way, there's a cuneiform tablet in the Berlin Museum which records two eclipses in one year. Now, that's a little bit unusual. And it's the year that Xerxes, the father of Artaxerxes, died. And that's 465 B.C. So from these lines of evidence, you can put in the nail and you can stretch out the 7 years, and we come to 457 B.C. And then we stretch out the 483 years to the coming of the Messiah. Now, that raises a question. What is a Messiah? Is a Messiah when he's born? No. A Messiah becomes a Messiah when he begins his public ministry, because the verb means to anoint. Literally, a Messiah is an anointed one. As you know, the priests and prophets were anointed in front of the pillars of the temple in Jerusalem. And so the Messiah was to be anointed, and the anointing signified the beginning of his messianic ministry. And we have that in the Gospel of John, when Jesus comes to John the Baptist at the Jordan River and he's anointed. This is when he became the Messiah, and that we know was 27 A.D., which incidentally is given us in the Gospel of Luke in terms of the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, who was the Caesar on the throne at the time when Jesus was baptized. Augustus was the Caesar who was on the throne when Jesus was born, but Tiberius was the Caesar on the throne when Jesus was anointed at the Jordan River by John. Well, what happens to him? Sad to say, verse 26, he's cut off. Now, you can be cut off in one of two senses. You can be cut off in the sense that you are expelled from the camp of Israel. But you can also be cut off from the land of the living. And that's what happens to the Messiah here. So this prophecy tells you the Messiah was not going to die an ordinary chronological old age death from an illness. He was going to be cut off, the verb is in the passive, because somebody else was going to do it to him. And from the Gospels, we know that was the Roman soldiers who crucified him. As he hung on that cross for 6 hours, he died. So he's cut off. The next phrase is very difficult. I'll illustrate to you how compact the Hebrew language is. It says here in the RSV that I'm reading, and commonly in many versions, he shall have nothing. There are two little Hebrew words here, and each word consists of two letters, a total of four letters. You see, the Hebrew Old Testament is one-third shorter than the English Old Testament because the language is so compact. So these four letters are pronounced Ein Lo. See, you had your Hebrew lesson for the day. Ein is the negative of the form of the verb to be. There shall not be. See, it takes four words to translate that one word. Lo is, L is the preposition, to or for, and the O is a pronominal suffix, to him. So literally, before you make a decision what this applies to, there shall not be to or for him. Well, there's an X that's missing in the middle of that sentence. Now, the RSV here says things. He shall not have any things. Well, we're more interested in things, and God is more interested in people. And so, really, when you take God's view of attention, it's talking about people. No one shall be for him. Now, remember, it's talking about the time when he was crucified. And at the cross, Nobody, absolutely nobody was on his side. Roman soldiers hung him there. The Jewish leaders engineered to get him there. Even his own disciples standing around the foot of the cross said, "We trusted this would be he who would deliver Israel." They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was all about. They didn't realize that he was providing the atonement that brings in everlasting righteousness. Well, what describes next is the destruction of the city. Its end shall come with a flood. That's a picture of troops flooding in through the broken walls and broken gates. As you know, the story of the temple. Titus, the Roman general leading the army at the time of the attack, wanted to preserve the temple. But unfortunately, the Jewish defenders retreated into the temple. So the temple became the strongest fortress in the city. So the Roman troops had to attack the temple. And as they attacked the temple, it was set on fire. The gold on the walls melted. The cedar and the walls burned. And the temple fell. And so the end came to the city and the temple. To illustrate how complete the Roman destruction was, there was an English archaeologist, a woman actually, Kathleen Kenyon, and she heard that the Lutherans were going to build a school on a certain lot inside the old walled city. And she asked for permission to do what an archaeologist calls a deep probe. They go straight down until they hit bedrock. They don't do a scientific excavation. They just want to see, get a sample of the strata of the destruction. She dug through 70 feet of Roman destruction debris to get to bedrock. You see, when the Romans destroyed the city, they scraped it off and they scraped it in, and they actually filled up one of the valleys that was in Jerusalem before. So that's how complete the Roman destruction was. Now, they did go back and rebuild the city partially, and then they rebelled again and it was destroyed again. As the proverb goes, the only thing we learn from history is we don't learn anything from history. In the final verse, verse 27, we have two more statements about the Messiah. He will make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. Jesus comes as the messenger of the covenant. Jesus came offering to the Jewish people what all of those restoration prophecies in the Old Testament said they could have had. And during the last week of his ministry, as he comes over the brow of the Mount of Olives, and he proceeds down into the city, he weeps. You should think this would be a great, glorious announcement. Instead, partially down the Mount of Olives, he breaks into tears. And then he says the verses at the end of Matthew 23, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if you'd only known the things that belong to your peace." You see, all those prophecies of the Old Testament that you could have had, but now they are hid from your eyes. A pronouncement, a sad, sad pronouncement. And then it says, in the midst of the week, the sacrifice and offering will cease. Sacrifices, bloody sacrifices of animals, offering as grain food offerings. Sacrificial system comes to an end. Now we have a little problem here. Because the temple stood for another 40 years after Jesus was crucified. And they continued to offer sacrifices in that temple for 40 years more. So is this prophecy wrong? No, it's not wrong. It's that the sacrifices and offerings no longer had a meaning. Because type had met antitype. All those animals for 2,000 years of the Old Testament sacrificial system looked forward to this one great culminating sacrifice. And when type meets antitype, you really don't need the type anymore. Now, God demonstrated that because you remember the veil in the temple was rent. as Jesus dies, showing the Old Testament sacrificial system had passed beyond its usefulness. Now, this occurred at a day which in the Christian calendar, the Episcopalian Church, I went to for a short time, we called it Good Friday. Well, it depends on how you look at it. You can call it Good Friday because it's good for us, right? We get salvation. We get atonement. We get everlasting righteousness. That's good. But what about the viewpoint from God's point of view? What about the viewpoint from the angel's point of view? What about the viewpoint from Jesus' point of view? And you'll notice the title on the sermon is, what is it, the worst day of the worst day in the calendar, the worst Friday ever? Something like that. Okay, there you are. Well, I want to read you just one quotation about God's point of view for these events. This is Desire of Ages. And this is page 752. And now the Lord of glory was dying, a ransom for the race. In yielding up his precious life, Christ was not upheld by triumphant joy. All was oppressive gloom. It was not the dread of death that weighed upon him. It was not the pain and ignominy of the cross that caused his inexpressible agony. Christ was the Prince of Sufferers, but his suffering was a sense of the malignity of sin, a knowledge that through familiarity with evil, man had become blinded to its enormity. Christ saw how deep was its hold of sin upon the human heart, how few would be willing to break from its power. He knew that without help from God, humanity would perish. He saw the multitudes perishing within reach of abundant help. With amazement, angels witnessed the Savior's despairing agony. The hosts of heaven veiled their faces from the fearful sight. It's not Good Friday from God's point of view. It's Bad Friday. It's very, very Bad Friday. But for us, who get the results of what he's accomplished, it's everlasting life. And one day he will welcome us to the gates of heaven because of the purchase that he made with his blood on the cross. May God bless each one of you with the knowledge of him as your Lord and Savior, and appreciate the marvelous gift that he has given you.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.